Welcome to the Men of 8 Gang Podcast, episode 355. I'm Steve Borsch, and I'm on with the lovely and talented Phil Wilson.
Why, thank you, Mr. Borsch.
And our buddy Tim Elliott is, he's shoveling his driveway or something today.
That was a little startling to wake up to snow this morning.
Yeah, I know. Well, of course, it's going to last 3 hours. Because it'll be gone in a nanosecond.
But still, it's like I said to Lori, what are you still doing in bed? Get out there and shovel, for God's sake.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Yeah. What does she think? This is a hotel or something?
Walk in the park? Come on. And just get to check out.
That's right. That's right. Well, I've been telling, in all seriousness, if anyone listening remembers the blizzard, the Halloween blizzard in what, 92 or something? I don't know if you were living up here, but
I wasn't, but no, I heard. Yeah, I hear about it
so,
every year. Yeah.
So that night of her trick or treat, I took Elizabeth out, and at that point she was, like 3 years old, and she had a big down jacket on. She insisted on going as Batman, and she looked like a little midget Batman on steroids. I mean, it was hilarious. Next morning I get up and I'm out snow blowing my driveway with my little snow pup, Toro snow pup. And
not
I look in the
nice.
Cul-de-sac and there's a woman snow blowing her driveway. And I thought, oh, geez, these guys, they were moving. And I figured her husband was gone. So I snow blowed a path over to the house in the cul-de-sac. And, it's about half a block. And I get over there and I help her. And then I said to her, hey, you should really move this car. Cause she was shoveling. There's like 2 feet of snow. And so she goes, okay, hang on. I got to get the keys. And she goes in the house. A couple minutes later, her husband and teenage son come out and he pats me on the back. And goes, hey man, thanks so much for doing that. And I was literally so stunned that I couldn't say anything. I couldn't even be mad.
Chivalry seems to be dead there.
That's
in
right.
Eden
oh,
Prairie.
Oh my gosh. I know. Anyway, let's talk about, there's only a few Minnesota stories. We got a great guest on today, so we don't want to delay too long.
Yeah.
But Minnesota is moving fast on hiring tech workers.
Well, yeah, it's interesting to see that what was the story? 5,500 tech workers they've added in 2015.
Yeah. And demand outstrips supply.
Yeah. So of course. There's still plenty of open spots. So that's a good thing and a bad thing, I guess. But,
well, I will tell you though that with all of the services that are going on, and as important as tech is, and all the integrations that have to be done, and then you have to maintain them and take care of them, and you have to do backup, and you want to move stuff to the cloud, and blah blah blah. I mean, there are a lot of businesses that simply cannot find the people with the expertise.
Agreed.
It's pretty tough. In fact, I'm dealing with a buddy now. It's got a business over in St. Paul, and it's not huge, and they've got bids that are, for backup and IT maintenance and all that. And I just looked at them and I went, well, it's either that or go buy a Mercedes S-Class, one of the two.
You're right.
It's like, this is insane, especially with all the stuff in the cloud that's available. But anyway, can't get the people to run the thing.
But, of course, it related to that was the story about Coco launching their effort to increase diversity in the hiring of that tech sector. So I thought that was a very interesting article I found in the Southwest Journal, which is a more offbeat publication. So it was really interesting to find it.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's I really like what they're doing. And so for everyone listening, we'll put a link in the show notes. You can read the article, obviously, but it's they're really reaching out to GLBT community, Black and Latino students, and really trying to accelerate the diversity. And again, if I was in high school right now, I would look at either cybersecurity or some IT role of some kind. I mean, it's just if you have any aptitude whatsoever for it.
Or any, even if you don't have aptitude, learn the aptitude. If you just like it intrigues you. Just, geez.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah,
it is, what was the average salary? Was $93,000,
yes.
Something like that, across the tech sector in Minneapolis. So,
well, I'll tell you what, I know a young man that just ended up with two new Microsoft certifications. And I asked them point blank, as a, you know, their server-based stuff, Microsoft Azure and cloud stuff and all that. And I said, so tell me, what did that really do for your income? And he said, you know what? I'm going to get a $20,000 bump. I said, nice. What? He goes, yeah, and plus they paid the tuition, and I got time to do studying during work hours. It's like, really?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, so they, like, bent over backwards. He's with an insurance company. They bent over backwards to support him because they you know, they're seeing this demand outstrip supply. They want to have good tech workers, and I mean, you know, and he was somebody who was going to go to trade school. And instead, he got into IT and got into storage area networks and stuff. So it's there. So if you got a young person in your life, anybody listening, you know, kind of give them a little cattle prod in the butt behind. And
well, there was, it's pretty big here too, because that Coco story did reference the tech hire initiative that Minnesota is involved with.
Yes.
And I put a link in the show notes to that. You can check that out. I'm working with a bunch of different firms that are trying to grow the tech workforce here. Like, you know, we've talked about Prime Academy and companies like that.
Right.
So you can check that out. It's a god-awful website, but you can check it out.
Yeah, it is.
It's the typical government website. It's
right.
Like, this is bad. So yep. Check that out. But I didn't have a chance to look into this, the 3M. They've got a state-of-the-art research and development lab now here.
Oh, man. Well, I wanted to go with her. My wife had a meeting over there 2 and a half weeks ago. And she said, Steve, I've got to take you over there. It's unbelievable. Of course, you know, they almost do a strip search, because they don't want anything in this facility, you know, that you got to give up your phone and they, you know, if you have any devices at all. And, you know, and there was a guy that was there that wanted to bring in his iPad because he takes notes on it. And I said, sorry, it's got a camera in it.
So it's an opportunity to see, you know, high tech R&D and get a cavity search at the same
time.
Right. So it's kind of a great way to spend an afternoon, I guess.
Well, you know, if you watch Orange is the New Black on Netflix, you can have some good experience when you're over there. Yeah. But I think that's pretty amazing. And what I really liked was our RBC Capital Markets in the bottom of the article, analyst put them down as a company to keep an eye on this year. And that's terrific. I mean, it's nice to see, because, you know, 3M is involved in so many core technologies that it's great to be able to kind of keep an eye on what they're doing and what the trends are that they're jumping in on, and kind of gives you a little bit of an idea of what's happening with, you know, manufacturing and finished goods and so on. So,
yep. So we do have a guest coming up, Greg Swan from Space 150, who's been working at South by Southwest this past week. I don't know if he's still in Austin or not, so we'll be getting to him. But we should probably check a little bit about what's going on elsewhere in the tech world outside of Minnesota.
No, there's
nothing at all.
Nah.
Nothing at all.
No, a lot of tech workers getting fired everywhere, every other state. No, I'm kidding.
Just kind of making that up, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, I put an article in here, and it's on backchannel.com. It's by Stephen Levy, who also wrote something on Medium, and I'll try to find that. You got to log in to read that. But the Back Channel article is called "Why Are We Fighting the Crypto Wars Again?" And if anybody remembers the Clipper chip from the 90s, you know, under the Clinton administration, to essentially, you know, connect up television and be able to control content access through the Clipper chip, but there was a back door in it. And the Clinton administration and the Department of Justice and the intelligence communities were driving this thing forward really hard until a cryptanalyst demonstrated that he'd broken into it. And the whole thing just evaporated. You know, because they were all claiming, no,
right.
You can't, right. No, you can't break into it. No, come on. And he broke into it. And it was a done deal. It sort of just went away. And Congress is not, especially because of this experience, you know, there's a lot of Congress critters, as Boing Boing calls them, that have remembrance of this adventure. And they're not too keen on the idea of dealing with this and dealing with encryption and all that. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be real interesting to see. Now, for everyone listening, tomorrow excuse me, Monday, the March 21st. Apple will have their big event where they're going to show a new phone, supposedly, and a new iPad, and who knows what else. The next day is when they go in and present their brief in this Apple FBI.
Too many acronyms.
Crypto thing. And so it's looking more and more like they've got a pretty strong case. And the FBI is a pretty weak one. And now you got the New York Times article about the Apple engineers that have said that, you know, if in fact the FBI were to win, we're not going to do it. We're going to quit. It's like, oh, geez. Okay. That's pretty cool. Amazing. Jeez. So, but read this article because it talks about, if you want kind of an overview on why this whole thing is a bad idea and why some of the cryptanalysts that are the fathers of this whole encryption movement in computing and why they're against it, it'll be a good thing to go through. So
yep. I did also put in a link to the show notes. I posted this to some friends, you know, to my contacts over the last week. There was a John Oliver from This Week Tonight.
It's fabulous, you guys.
A quick little discussion about gives a little clarity to the encryption situation.
Yeah, he did a great job on that.
As he always does.
Yeah. I thought it was hilarious. He did not do such a good job explaining to Stephen Colbert about the event, because Colbert brought it up about the show. And I don't think he did as good of a job of counteracting the encryption thing as he did on his show, but
still. Well, you know, when you're not working from a script, it's a little more difficult.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So. And that's why we write every single thing we say down.
Sure.
In the show notes. So
you do that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, everything I'm saying right now, I'm reading.
Get out. Really? Yeah. Good for you, man. Nice job. I never would have known.
Thanks.
Tell me about Steve McQueen. No, I'm sorry. Project McQueen.
Well, so Project McQueen, Apple's building its own cloud infrastructure. So there was a big thing that happened this week where they were moving off of Amazon Web Services, and people were the conjecture was that they were going to move to do more at Microsoft Azure, but it turns out that they're moving to Google's cloud platform, and as an interim step, because they've been building out their own network. And what's interesting about this is that if you follow this kind of stuff, which I do, Apple's actually been building out their own content delivery network, their own CDN, for a long time, because they were paying so much money to Akamai. Mm-hmm. And Akamai is the company that has all those edge. I mean, they've got thousands of edge servers around the world, and you can Akamize your video and images and all of that. And they push it out to the edge so that when somebody comes from Japan to watch a video on your site, it's as though it's being served by a server, you know, down the street, instead of having to fetch it from California or wherever your data centers are. They wanted to have their own because they were they were writing checks like crazy to Akamai. Mm-hmm. Same thing here. So why spend all this money and give it to Microsoft or Amazon or Google? And why not just do it yourself?
Yeah, exactly.
So
why the name McQueen? Do you have any idea? Is there any explanation on that?
I have not been able to find out why. You know, it's an homage to Steve McQueen, of course.
Well, maybe.
Maybe because he was his own man and marched to his own drummer or something. I
Ooh, that's deep, Steve. That's deep.
I know. It's, you know, that's how I am. I'm kind of an analyst when it comes to reading between the lines, you know. You know how it is. Come
right,
on, Phil.
Exactly. Yeah, but listen, before we get to Greg, I did want to mention that, you know, and Greg did a really great talk for us at Mobile Twin Cities on smartwatches and Internet of Things and that sort of thing some time back. But we've talked about, was actually a cool thing the week one time for me, was the Fossil Q watch.
Did you buy one?
I actually bought one this week, the Grant model. And I just wanted to, you know, chat a little bit about my experience with that. It's probably on its way back. So,
really,
it really is a very nice looking watch. It's clearly what I feel is the, you know, where smartwatches need to go. I think they're definitely more, very much the same as a piece of jewelry. They look like a watch. They, you know, they don't necessarily have the readout the screen. But the most important thing that I like about a smartwatch is that I don't miss notifications, I don't miss text messages, and I don't miss phone calls because my phone is not necessarily with me. It's either on my desk or silenced or something like that. And the cue from Fossil basically does that. I mean, it'll count steps, it'll do all that stuff and run it through an app, but it gives a nice, it has an LED flash when you get a message, and it has a vibration. The vibration is almost imperceptible. You just you can't feel it. There is a setting for it that you can have a, you know, increase the intensity, but even on its highest setting, you can't feel it. And of course you're not spending a great deal of time looking at your watch, so you don't necessarily see the LED flashes, and they are just instantaneous flashes. So great concept. You know, I've talked with their or communicated with their customer service, and they of course were happy to tell me about how to increase the intensity with the settings, and it's like
guys.
It didn't work. So just thought I'd share that with you guys. So great looking watch, and again, very much a classic looking watch.
Yeah, I'll put a link in the show notes because it is a nice looking watch.
Yeah, but, I will. Okay. That said, let's say we bring on our guest, Greg Swan, who is now currently with Space 150. Greg has been around in the tech scene here in Minneapolis for a long time. One of the first guys I met, just a really great guy at the time, was with Weber Shandwick, and where he wrote his own, you know, the job description there, and did a lot with tech and you know, IoT and things like that, but has just celebrated his first year at Space 150 and has also spent a great deal of time working with South by Southwest. I think he's on their board and then also had some presentations.
Greg Swan, ladies and gentlemen.
Hi, good. Greg.
How you
good
doing, buddy?
Morning. How are you guys?
Well, good. We're not doing video only because we're not certain on the peer-to-peer stuff yet in terms of bandwidth use and recording and all that. You know, I don't know, Greg, we've been on Skype since 2008, and for Skype, Microsoft, it's just gotten so flaky that we decided to do Hangouts. And the audio quality is so much better, but we're trying some new recording formats, and we don't, you know, we're not doing video only because I'm just not sure that I got enough bandwidth and all that stuff. So,
yeah, no problem at all.
So, how you doing there?
I'm good. I was trying to figure out how to turn off my video, but I
can't. It's in the top bar. If you hover over the top bar, there is a video. But though that picture of your scalp is lovely,
I know. Well, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
I'm great.
So are you home now or are you still in Austin?
I am home after 7 days in Austin. It's been very exciting to be home and reacquaint myself with my kids.
So. That's great. So tell us about you. You are, you're on the board with South By, am I right?
I'm on the advisory board, just the programming committee, which means I get to review about 200 sessions, and from those, they ask you to pick five that you would recommend. So it's the scrutiny is very high and gets higher every year. And I will tell you, so I get to participate in the Intelligent Future track, which is probably my favorite of all of them, kind of the what's next, what's around the corner. Mm-hmm. And it was really humbling this fall to get the opportunity to read all of those. The community of South By, the community of integrators, disruptors, innovators from around the world is really, really special.
That's great. So, you know, I went to South By, I think, years ago. You were there, and it was, I think, 2009 that we went, and it was my first time there. And is it still as I don't know if you want to say relevant? Is it still as huge as an event? Has it changed over the course? It seems like it's kind of gone from a sort of an innovation showcase to more of a interactive business marketing brand sort of thing. How has it changed over the years?
So this was my 10th year attending, and looking back 10 years ago, you know, that's pre-iPad, pre-iPhone, pre-Twitter, you know, just apps, like app culture.
Yeah.
And so there weren't a lot of marketers at the show. It was really a place where, you know, South by Interactive was a place where there were a lot of engineers, technologists. And at the time, like, I was one of a few marketers kind of walking around like, wow, like these are my people, but I want to use this technology as a layer atop which I can help clients tell stories through technology. And not a lot of branding. And I think that that's one of the biggest criticisms of the show from some of that old guard. This was the 30th year of South by Southwest, their anniversary. And so, you know, the old guard, the original, you know, founders and the people who used to come and listen at the first few years of the interactive keynote, Bruce Sterling, who's a futurist, he wrote the very first cover article for Wired magazine, and he's always given the closing keynote at South By. After the keynote, everyone would go over to Bruce's house for drinks after the keynote.
Oh, really?
And so, you know, this year, you know, you see him standing in front of this massive room giving his prediction, which often come true, mind you, about South By. And you know, and it just seems laughable as we're standing in the, you know, the Bud Light sponsored lounge. And so, with that said, the reason that the sponsors are there, the reason that you can catch a Mazda car over to the Dell lounge and wear the Budweiser Beer Garage Oculus Rift headset is because there's people there. And those people are influential, and they spend money, and they have big ideas.
Yeah.
And last year, I think, I thought the director of South By, Hugh Forrest, he had a really great quote, as there was a lot of criticism about the conference just getting too big and has it jumped the shark, and him saying, you know, if the original, like, old school folks, like, don't want to come anymore, that's fine. They should stay home, because there's plenty of 20, 30-year-old innovators who are ready for what's next, and let's make room for them.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good way to put it. Though, so did you guys all just pile into a car and then go to his house for drinks?
Oh, I wish. Oh my gosh.
Wouldn't that be fun?
How many thousands of people show up there for Interactive now?
I don't know what I think the final number last year was like 35,000. So it had to be probably closer to 40 this year. The city of Austin's pretty small, and it's not necessarily set up for a big conference like Las Vegas would be. So there's also, you know, every year there's that trouble of how to get around to all the different sessions. The lines are longer than ever. If you have a session you want to see, you need to be in line at least 30, 45 minutes in advance, which means sometimes you have to leave a good session that you're in and head over to the next one.
Right. Right. Still, great time, though. So what were some of the highlights? Tell us about it, Greg.
Yeah.
So I would say that this was the big year that we experienced a lot of VR, a lot of immersive reality experiences. And this is similar to my CES experience where it seemed like every booth had some sort of gear or Google or Oculus experience. At CES this year, I wore more than 50 headsets.
Wow.
Besides coming home with pink eye, I also came home. And
nice.
No, that's a joke. I did come home with this sense of like, you know, there's something really here. Like we're hitting this tipping point where, this isn't just booth bait and there is an opportunity for someone to do something cool with this. So, this year, multiple brands had VR experiences, including, McDonald's. They had the HTC Valve Vive set up and you could walk around and decorate the inside of a Happy Meal. The Vive is hands down the best VR experience I've ever done because you are unrestricted from a chair and you're actually able to see your hands and walk around. And it was cool to see how McDonald's did it. It wasn't the best experience I've ever seen, but it was definitely the best at South By. Anheuser-Busch also had, within their beer garage, they had an Oculus Rift kind of tour of their brewery. And you could smell the hops or the wort cooking, and you could touch the wood, and everyone's kind of wearing gear, sitting in rows and chairs, which was, it was also very good. I think that the idea that we all sat in a swivel chair and watched a movie is probably not something we'll see in future years, but it was definitely important this year.
So I got a question for you. So yeah. Related to VR, of course, but I remember how everyone was tripping all over themselves in marketing world with respect to Second Life. and build, you know, buying islands and building, you know, experiences in Second Life and all of that. And do you think that, that VR and all the various companies that are in the space, do you think that is truly going to gain traction and really be a dominant direction?
So it's a great question, right? It's like, but I remember when there was hype around Second Life. I remember when there was hype around Google Glass. Like, you can look back and be like, well, those things died. No one talks about Second Life. No one talks about MySpace anymore. No one talks about Google Glass, or that we laugh about it. So I get really excited about new paradigms for connecting brands and people, or people to people, and how can brands join that conversation. So Second Life was really fun. It was one of the first times that we got to think about how a brand should operate in a virtual space and interact with people. So even though we're no longer talking about, you know, the H&R Block Second Life area where you could go and get your taxes done, and very few people did that, but it was an opportunity for H&R Block to think internally and their agency partners to think about, if a brand is on the internet only and interacting with a person on the internet only, what should that experience be? And we learned a lot about that specific insight that we've now taken into Facebook and Twitter. And now as we think about dark social and messenger apps, those are learnings that were important to be there. And I would say the same with MySpace. Like, we spent hundreds of thousands of dollars building MySpace pages and learning how a brand should be on a social network. That wasn't for naught because MySpace is gone. We took all of that learning and we've applied that to Facebook and Twitter and now dark social. So with VR specifically and 360 video, the reason I say immersive content is that I'm not necessarily putting all my eggs in an Oculus or a PlayStation VR or a Gear basket. It's more, there's definitely a unique insight here where a human being can be sitting in their home and be transported to a different world. And then how does a brand interact in that moment? And especially with PlayStation VR coming up, where I'm going to be able to play Battlefront against my friends in a 360 environment. That's pretty exciting. And the fact that there's been 5 million Gears sold or given away, 5 million, what was the other one? 5 million cardboards have been sold or given away. And then with PlayStation VR launching, like, it's coming. And it's one of the reasons that so when we were at CES this year, we covered the show only in 360. And I carried my Ricoh Theta S camera around. We had to build a WordPress plugin that could support that 360 content on a mobile device. And it was fun. It was a fun experiment, and we were getting stopped everywhere, just like I used to get stopped for Google Glass, with people saying, what's that kind of camera? What are you doing? And the shock, like, kind of this like awe. And even at South by, like, we were taking a 360 photo at dinner one night, at a client dinner, and the waitress like stopped and came over, and she was like, could you please take a picture of me with that and then text it to me?
That's great.
You know, and we did it, but I'm excited about what's next in immersive content. I think that, again, like, marketers have a huge opportunity because we have budgets to define what that experience is going to be like.
Well, see, you know, the one thing that I was really, really excited about was augmented reality. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, buzzwords du jour for a while. Mm-hmm. And again, that kind of dropped off, and it's really all about VR and all of that. And I remember being at a SIGGRAPH in the mid 90s, and Jean Lanier was there, and that was my first experience with a VR headset. And he was actually giving the demo, and it was hooked up to a Silicon Graphics workstation. And it was just like, it was so rudimentary. I mean, I look back on that experience now, I was like, oh, come on, seriously? And compare that to my first Oculus Rift experience. And but augmented reality is so approachable, and it's so there, and it's so easy. And especially when I travel, I really, really, really want historical information in an augmented reality way that I can superimpose over today's buildings or streets, or, you know, and have an experience that allows me to kind of do this mental A-B comparison between what it was like then and what it's like now. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to put a, I'm not going to carry a, an Oculus Rift with me, even if it could connect to a device, a handheld device, and put that on while I'm walking around in a space. Yeah. So I'm wondering, in terms of traction and in terms of brands potentially driving forward with augmented reality content, and then you would, you know, feel good about that brand because they're making your experience on your travel that much better and yada, yada, yada. Where is that in this whole mix?
That's a really, really smart question, because I believe that augmented reality is actually, we've barely scratched the surface of the power of augmented reality on our lives. It's one of the reasons I was so excited about Glass is that it unlocks that digital filter over the physical world that you need a lens to look through to see. So they really, you know, Google really messed up the privacy implications and just kind of the cultural side of people wearing cameras on their faces. That was a big PR mess up, and they really let us down as explorers. But some of the innovations that came out of that experiment have stuck. So Erasma, which is one of the big augmented reality apps that you can download on your phone and hold up to things, they're a major sponsor at South by this year. And I will tell you, so Robert Scoble left Rackspace a week ago. Mm-hmm. And he had let kind of some in his circle know that was going to happen, and he's been doing some messaging around that. And I had the opportunity to have dinner with him last week and just kind of talk to him a little bit about like his move away from like overall futurist at Rackspace and like going all in with the Meta VR too, going all in on AR. And what he's saying is that AR is actually the future. And if you think about heads-up displays in your car as a near-term solution to fully autonomous vehicles, as you think about like just kiosks and experiences where we can continue to find a way to unlock that digital layer on the physical world, that's actually, he's very bullish on where that's coming. And I tend to listen to him. So I'm excited about what we're going to make in that area.
But didn't he say Google Plus and Google, Google Glass was the future too?
Yeah.
Isn't Robert sort of kind of a bandwagoner to some extent?
Well, so I think he and I share a lot of the same DNA where like, I'm really excited about the next thing and I want to check it out and push it as far as I can and learn something from it and apply it to the next thing.
Yeah, but so, I think that you tend to be a little bit more, analytical about it, a little
cynical.
Less. Cynical, yeah, because I think that all new technology deserves a little bit of cynicism to get to look at it. And but I never get that feeling with Robert. I always feel like, this is great, and especially if he gets paid to talk about it. So, that's one of those things that I got to tell you, Greg, I'll take your word over Robert Scoble's any day. So,
well, one more thing on kind of like AR VR. So, yes. So the Meta 2 is coming out. The Microsoft HoloLens is coming out.
Yep.
And if you've watched the demo of Minecraft in HoloLens, and your kids play Minecraft, and you've ever even like picked up a controller or played it on your iPad, it is phenomenal to be able to see this, like, because we are like, we us three guys, like, we're the Lego guys, right? Like, we made stuff in Legos, and like, my kids like Legos too, but they love Minecraft and they love building things together. And the opportunity for me to be able to give them an experience to unlock these digital block creations that they've made and see them in the physical world on a table in front of them, it's really, really exciting. And I think that consumers are going to be excited about it too.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. So what else? I mean, was that the pretty much the dominant really takeaway from South was AR? And
so I kind of have three. So the first would be the rise of immersive storytelling. The second would be dark social or next generation social. And the third is privacy and just the tension of impermanence, or the tension of who we are and who we're going to be years from now. So Mark Jensen, who's our chief innovation officer, and I gave a presentation on dark social. So dark social being the layer of communication that isn't public. So surface social being when I'm tweeting, when I'm posting publicly on Facebook and everyone can see my content, and those tweets are stored in the Library of Congress, right? Things that I write on my blog that are stored in Google and the Wayback Machine and they're cached, that content is theoretically around forever. And what we're seeing is more and more consumers moving that public conversation to dark social. So I'm interested in this from a marketing perspective because obviously, like, we've counseled clients for years to join the conversation and to do social listening and pay attention to what brands are or what your fans, friends, and followers or your consumers are talking about. And what happens when a significant portion of that conversation, particularly from Generation Z, goes dark? When instead of posting on Twitter how they feel about your brand or what they're doing today, they're actually sharing that conversation in Snapchat, in Kick, in Yik Yak, in text messages, and maybe even email. And so it's a really interesting brand paradox to think about. Like, it's still important to listen. And that's always been a very small audience population that we based that off of, right? It wasn't always everyone talking about, you know, I'm eating a ham sandwich on Twitter, and if I'm Subway, I want to know that. But fewer and fewer people are doing that. And so how does a brand interact with a consumer in Kick, in Snapchat, in a way that adds value to them? And also, it could be that customer service is headed that way as well.
But wouldn't you agree that that there'll be on-ramps to those services in the same way that a lot of us, and I still do, but I'm not going to go there, push back on the walled garden of Facebook? And, you know, and Zuckerberg and crew, they drove this, you know, in a very smart way, is they provided all these on-ramps for brands to play, for small businesses, for people with a cause, you know, by building pages. And there's lots of different ways to interact with the populace on Facebook. And yeah, it costs money and all of that. But do you see the same sort of thing happening with other services, so that there would be an opportunity to interact with people even in dark social, and then it would be up to them to opt in to be public by clicking a button or a link or watching a video and then
it's a good question. I mean, so if we look at, like, what's happening with WeChat in Asia, where, like, they don't have the baggage of desktop computing and desktop computers or even, you know, the networks, and so it's a mobile first culture where WeChat is the place. So there's this idea of, like, oh wow, when this comes to the States, like, if, like, Steve, if you and I are chatting in about, like, you know, cars, and all of a sudden there's going to be a Ford F-150 ad that just pops up in the middle of our chat conversation, and that feels bad. That feels really gross.
Yeah.
And I heard that example used multiple times, including that example of being said, like, that's not what's going to happen. So what I think is going to happen is new social networks, including chat apps, messenger apps, are not designed for brands, just like Facebook and Twitter and MySpace were not designed for brands. And what happened with those three, Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, is we registered brand accounts for, like, on them. And the social networks said, no, we don't want you to have brand accounts. Brands aren't people. They shouldn't have accounts. And, you know, what happened specifically with Facebook is, like, you could create a fan page. So, like, I created the Rocky Rococo's Pizza fan page. And eventually, like, Rocky Rococo's took it over. And that's a longer story. Yeah. When they realized, oh, well, we should have business pages, right? We should have a place for them. Twitter specifically didn't want brands to have accounts. They wanted, and so then all of a sudden they did allow you to have accounts. What we're seeing with Snapchat is, and I know I've been a huge, like, Snapchat advocate for 3 years, like, pushing, like, this is so important. we're at this tipping point right now where they're making money and where there is an audience and brands are saying like, oh, we got to go here. And the tools that Snapchat have for those brands are buying pre-roll videos.
Yeah, I see that's, yeah.
And so, and specifically, and you know, 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, I was in New York meeting with the lead sales guy. And he was like, brands can be friendly, but they're not your friends. So we don't want you to set up branded accounts on Snapchat. We want you to buy pre-roll video. And I was like, look, I understand, but I've heard the same crap from Facebook and Twitter mm-hmm. when they were at your stage. Like, brands are going to have accounts. They are going to want to talk to people. And like, you know, if you're just getting onto Snapchat, like follow Taco Bell, follow Beats by Dre, and follow DJ Khaled, and just and White House and CBS News and Good Morning America,
BuzzFeed.
Like, oh, thank you very much, Buzz. Yeah, yeah.
Good one, Phil.
Mike, MIC, like they're doing a fantastic job, right? So what's interesting? So BuzzFeed's fascinating, right? So like you could have a Discover Channel. Which is fine, but people aren't swiping over and looking at that stuff.
Yeah.
And so I do believe in the long term, I'm sorry to long way of answering your question. I do believe in the long term, like brands will continue to function as a person or as a brand within accounts, as well as having that surround sound advertising. You know, like I'm the PR social guy who's not the biggest fan of banner ads, although I understand they work. And so like, I don't want to try to find a way to put banner ads into these chat apps. What I want to do is try to find a way to add utility. So the last point on that would be like, well, how do we do that? Well, whatever we do today isn't what we'll do, you know, a year from now. And so you have to like approach it from a pilot perspective of let's figure out what we're going to do and do some test and learns and try things. And you know what? We might fail. We might learn, like we might laugh a year from now, but let's try. So Bonin Bao, who is the head of digital at Mondelez, and you know Mondelez owns Oreo, Honey Made, Ritz Crackers, he gave a really interesting talk about, and this is a little buzzwordy, but instead of trying to find unicorns, building dragons and then riding them, and dragons meaning like so instead of like finding a way to like be on Snapchat, like what if you build your own mobile game app? And then sell it in the app store and make back 10 times the amount of money you spent on making that app.
Yeah.
And as he and Mondelez are like, as they're pushing, and they're one of the most innovative companies right now, as far as like, you know, what Oreo's doing in social, what Honeymaid's done in social progressive messaging, what Ritz Crackers has built this website called Cheese Rank. It's like the BuzzFeed for cheese. Sorry, Phil. Like they're making money. They made $5 million on one of these properties last year. And it's a marketing vehicle. And so that's a dragon in Bonin's, terminology. So what Bonin started doing at South By, and if you were there, you saw it, is his new book came out and it's called Text Me, and his cell phone number is on the cover of the book. And his cell phone number was spray painted on every sidewalk in Austin. And it just texted me and it's his phone number.
Wow.
And he showed me his phone and it was obviously blowing up. But what they've done is they built software that allows him to be able to receive a huge amount of text messages and get back to people in a way that is in his voice, sometimes as him, sometimes as an artificial intelligence or chatbot, but in a way that feels personal, where he's able to use this as an experiment to figure out, if I'm a brand on a chat app, how am I interacting with people and what am I learning? And how can they feel like I'm being personal and responsive and there's a human behind it, but I can reach scale, which is very reminiscent to what Frank Eliason started building with Comcast Cares, what, like 4 or 5 years ago.
And did a beautiful job.
And he did a beautiful job. Yeah. And he trained consumers to bitch about their service publicly in a way that is stored in the Library of Congress forever.
Yeah.
And so like, it was really smart because that's where the conversation was. But we also trained consumers that when you have a problem, if you bitch online in a very public way, you're going to get more attention. And dark social is a really interesting opportunity for us to bring that conversation back privately, one-to-one, from both a customer service and also like a utility perspective as well.
Well, okay. So let me just, Phil's probably going, hey, we're running out of time, but I,
no, I'm not. I'm okay. Not cause
I have to ask.
I'm wrapped with attention.
I have to ask this. Well, so at a mini WebCon now, it's probably 3 years ago, the keynoter was Doc Searles, you know, Clue Train Manifesto. Mm-hmm. And now he's at the Berkman Center at Harvard working on a bunch of things related to the internet and so on, but primarily something called Vendor Relationship Management or VRM. And the whole point of that is to help to foster an intention economy where intention, not attention, and to really provide consumers with tools to interact with vendors that are a win-win on both sides. Mm. And one example of that is I'm interested in downloading a white paper. And so I go and I fill out their form and I get a white paper on, you know, some storage company or whatever. And I know when I do that, they will never, ever leave me alone. So I use disposable email addresses. So now they have no connection to me whatsoever. But in a VRM world, the tool is that I put my intention out there. Okay, so I have intention to buy a digital SLR camera. And Nikon and Canon and the mirrorless camera companies come after me and all of that, knowing that if I, as a consumer, Steve Borsch, buys a Canon, then I'm going to buy Canon cameras probably for the rest of my life, or I'm going to buy a lot of lenses and accessories. Mm-hmm. And so on. So the lifetime value of me as a customer is greater. And we're still not in an equal position. We still don't have, you know, like now I have an intention to buy a rechargeable plug-in hybrid, probably of a new 2017 Volt. It's my cool thing this week, and I'll get to that in a minute. But mm-hmm. And so that's great, but there might be some things that I'm not aware of and things that other vendors may want to pitch me on the efficacy of their approach. And Tesla may come after me and say, oh, don't do that. We'll give you a great lease deal for 24 months. Mm-hmm. And I may do that. But, what is happening from your perspective with your brands, because you have a laundry list of A-class, world-class brands that you're dealing with, obviously, and have dealt with in the past, with respect to some kind of a vendor relationship management direction where it doesn't matter if you're on the dark web or in dark social, it doesn't matter if you're public, that you will put your intention out there in some mechanism that brands can react to. Because at the end of the day, yes, you want people to feel good about your brand and you want them to have all of these, you know, intangible senses about quality and integrity and truthfulness and all of that. But at the end of the day, you want people to buy stuff. I mean, that's how they keep the lights on. And so I'm just wondering what mm-hmm. directionally you see happening, or is it just still sort of in the philosophical stage?
So that gets to kind of my third takeaway, which is like privacy. And so there is a paradox between privacy and value. There's a trade-off there. So the more information that I give up to marketers, the greater and the more customized advertising or my experience is. So by using Amazon and like based on your agreement of their terms on being on their site and being logged in, they're tracking what cameras you're searching for. And then as you go back to Facebook or as you go to another website, they're going to retarget you with ads with things that you looked at, even things that maybe you like accidentally clicked on, you're getting retargeted, or maybe yeah. even something you bought, you're still getting retargeted for that. So, but that's a trade-off where Amazon's recommendation engine is actually amazing.
It is.
By allowing yeah. Spotify to know everything I'm listening to, it's able to make recommendations of what else I might like. By allowing Facebook to track all of my likes and clicks and surfing behaviors, they're able to use to improve the edge rank to deliver content in my news feed that they think is more relevant to me. By allowing Alexa to listen to every single thing that is said in my home, I'm able to get a really cool value from being able to turn her on and off and ask her questions with my Amazon Echo. Mm-hmm. And so what's in it from a publisher perspective, brands, and specifically, so Alexis Madrigal coined the term dark social in 2012, looking at traffic to The Atlantic and noticing that more than half of that traffic was untrackable. Like, where did it come from?
Over
like,
half? What,
over half. And so where did it, like, is it coming from email sharing from URLs that don't have any tracking data? So the data after, you know, when you look at like, you know, atlantic.com/whatever the article name is/ and then some specific gibberish. So that's UTM tracking data. So like, if it doesn't have that, they don't know where that came from. Or if it was a link texted to me. So, hey, Phil, I got texted a link to BuzzFeed this morning that had no tracking data. So BuzzFeed's really, really, like, really, really aggressive, assertive, and smart in this, where they are now generating a unique URL for every single page you look at. So if you just pull up a BuzzFeed URL, click on it, just watch your browser URL bar, and you'll actually see it generate a unique hash of data just for you. So that if my grandma cut and paste that URL and add this data that shows up to 90% of people cut and paste URLs and send them to people. So if that happens, you're still able to track where that came from and where it went. So that tracking is getting way, 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 way smarter. And that allows us to better have this like web of data to understand how traffic is flowing. But on the privacy side, there is an aspect of like of data decay. Or Cory Doctorow gave a speech at South By called "The Right to Be Forgotten," and what we're seeing happening in Europe with privacy and just even you know, if you're on TimeHop, which pulls up your digital footprint from a year ago today, like tweets that I made, Facebook posts I had today, a year ago today, 2 years ago today, 3 years ago today. And I look at these tweets, I look at these things that I posted 8, 9, 10 years ago, and I'm really embarrassed. Like I'm really not that person anymore. And I really can't believe that I posted some of that stuff. And it's nothing like, you know, it's nothing horrible, but it's just like, man, there's some attitude in that one that like I'm not proud of that. And I don't really want to see that again. And I kind of am sad that that's on the internet forever. And that, you know, in the future, I think that our great grandkids, there will be jobs where they're like data archaeologists and they will be digging into that stuff. And so there's this tension going on with privacy and just like impermanence. So where like, well, what if you create content and it doesn't live forever? And that, again, like that's the beauty of ephemeral media like Snapchat or Tapstack, you know, or Vidku or some of these other sites, these other networks that are being created where they're specifically designed that data doesn't live forever. Can you hack them? Sure. Can you take a screenshot? Sure. But on their, like at their heart, it's content designed not to live forever.
Well, you know, that brings up one other thing, and I'm sorry, Phil, for because I keep going on and on here, but that brings...
What am I? You're the timekeeper, not me.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks, Dad. So that really brings up a conversation that I had last night with my wife, and it was about what's happening with millennials, but more specifically with Gen Z on essentially being disillusioned about what's going on. And I looked at her and I just said, well, you know, I mean, can you blame them? I mean, here, Wall Street, you know, essentially brings down the global economy and nobody's accountable. The NSA has discovered to have been essentially archiving every single thing they can and putting things in between Google data centers so they can grab stuff that's not end-to-end encrypted and blah, blah, blah. You know, why would they not be cynical? Why would they not be disillusioned? And what's been interesting to me is... and concerning is the fact that there hasn't been any kind of an effort by Wall Street, by the investment bank specifically, or any kind of an effort with the intelligence community at all to counteract that in any way, shape, or form. And I'm wondering if that is in any way, especially with Gen Z, but is that impacting the drive toward the dark social apps and so on? Is that going to end up being something where people are going to get really, really, really smart about how to hide?
I think that's really smart. And I mean, where I see it even just in the creative industry, where we've got creative directors who aren't on social at all, and they're almost proud of it, right? And and there's this aspect of like being told in college, like anything you post online will haunt you forever, and it'll keep you from getting a job, and it'll affect your dating life because someone's going to look up all your past photos on Facebook and not want to date you, or you know, and. So I do think there's a social response to that. I think there's also an aspect of so now that we have photos in our cameras, you can capture and take a photo of everything. And there's no limit to the amount of photos you can take. It's all then stored to the cloud. It's there forever. It's awesome. 3 weeks ago, I took my annual unplugged vacation. So my wife and I went to the Bahamas. I turned my phone off. I put it in a safe for a week. I took one photo the entire week.
Wow.
And it was for my kids. And I came home, and you know what? I have memories of the trip, but it's like, it's old school memories, right? They're in my brain.
Yeah.
And I remember a lot, but what photos did I miss out on taking? Like pictures of the beach. I missed out on like posting pictures of me on the beach while everyone in Minnesota is freezing. And I could have posted that on social and like taunted you. And then I would have had to like keep checking it to see how well my taunts did and how many shares and likes and stuff did my taunts get. It's like, I didn't really miss anything. So at South By, there was this session on data decay and the idea of like, of when you take a photo of something like the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel with this beautiful picture, you know, with God and the fingers touching and stuff. When you're in the Sistine Chapel and you're looking up at the ceiling, it's this aura of just like magnificent art, right? And you're there and you take a picture of it and post it online, and we're familiar with the image. It doesn't really have that same aura because you weren't there. You don't really have the feeling associated. It's nice to have a picture. And so across the hallway from this session where we're talking about this and really getting deep into the you know, psychological and sociological implications of that, across the hallway is an art installation, and it's an orb. It's an orb about, it's probably like 20 by 20 feet tall, a giant rotating planet, blown up ball. Inside of it is projected swirls like Jupiter. There's giant speakers with subwoofers going wah, 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 wah. And like, depending on how many people are standing in the room, it's changing and it's listening to us and it's moving. And I laid underneath it, Phil and Steve, I laid underneath it. And it's like, it's swirling and it's going wah, 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 wah. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And then I stood up and my friend Mark took a picture of it and I looked at his phone and it looks like a circle. It looks like he took a picture of like a circle of Jupiter, right? Like, It cannot be recreated. If you weren't there,
yeah,
you missed it. You missed it if you weren't there. And I do think that there's some sort of we're headed towards this backlash of like, when everything is recorded, when everything is stored forever, you miss it. When you're always looking at the world through the lens of your camera or through your phone, and you're always so focused on sharing it online, you're going to miss out on something. And so, you know, it's too, like, you know, there's a quote from South By that says, for Generation Z, if they're at an experience and can't share it, they weren't at that experience. So that's Brian Solis. So that's true. And as marketers, we must be making experiences that are designed to have people take out their phones and share it. But on the flip side, we need to understand that sometimes just being there in the moment is what's most important.
You know, though, as an amateur historian, my dad, when he was alive, used to tell me stories about my great-grandparents, my great-grandfather in specific. And at one point, 10 years before he died, he got a set of videotapes. Somebody had found a 16-millimeter film of all kinds of stuff from both sides of the family. And two of the cousins, older cousins, did a voiceover telling about who was in the thing and so on. Here are my great-grandparents walking out of a house in South Minneapolis, waving at the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And to see them actually, and it was in color, and to see them actually moving, and it was one of the most powerful things that's ever happened to me. And I know nobody else is like, oh, really? Really, Steve? What about the birth of your children? Anyway, but the point is that I love the fact that I'm keeping all my podcasts from 2005 on, when I did my own personal one for a couple of years, because I think, how awesome would it be to be able to listen to my great grandfather on a podcast from, you know, 1890. And having him talk about, well, you know, agriculture is kind of going away and everybody's moving to the city. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, and so there's that, that, to me, that's kind of the flip side. It is kind of cool to have this, this archive. The only downside is it's not centric to someone as a human being. It's just sort of all over the place.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that the difference is there's scarcity, kind of pre-digital archival, there's a scarcity of that information where, like, that film of your grandparents, I have a cassette tape of, that my grandpa recorded for his grandkids' grandkids, and he's passed away now, and, like, I got that converted to an MP3, and so I've got it, right? And Jason Scott from the Internet Archive Project, I went to one of his sessions at South By last year where he's talking about, like, save everything. We must save everything and like, view it all as like, beyond copyright. Like, we must save everything. And I agree. We are in a save everything culture where, because everything is saved, and increasingly there's cameras on every street corner, cameras in every house. The narrative clip is a camera that you wear on your shirt. It takes a photo every 30 seconds. Like, we have so much data now. I think I'm seeing a shift, or I predict a shift, more towards experiences where you can just be in the moment as a response to that.
Yeah. Well, and we should just be in the moment because we're actually, we've run out of time.
Oh, and also before we,
just one thing, just real quickly, I need to just mention that now that we know where you live, Greg, we're going to come over with cameras and mount them on the trees near your home so that we can archive everything.
That's great, man. So, I have three USB cameras all across my house, including one outside, so I'll see you coming.
All right. Go ahead, Phil.
I was going to ask, now, beyond the information, beyond the business aspect of South By, what was your favorite moment at South By? Was it laying under the orb, or was it something else?
So I really enjoy walking the trade show where the, like, the early innovators are, and there's things like the tip-activated bubble machine for busking, or there was a Lego VR experience where you could actually build houses in CAD with Lego. And there was one that was this teddy bear that it was two teddy bears where you could give one to, like, a cousin of your kid, and the cousin maybe lives in another town, mm-hmm. and when you squeeze your teddy bear, his, like, your cousin's teddy bear, her teddy bear, all, like, vibrates, right? Like,
okay.
And
so
that's cool.
It's like using haptics to connect social objects that are for kids to, like, build connections between the two of them is really special. And I've seen a few things like that, like buttons that are cameras and that sort of thing. And so, again, like, it's really early, but, like, I'm excited about that. Like, bringing more of an emotional, like, emotional level to computing is pretty exciting. The only other thing would be, again, like, emotive computing, Ray Kurzweil like predicted this in 1999 with his book Spiritual Machines. It's coming. And that idea of, like, using technology to form an emotional connection between humans and also with machines. And so the other thing would be kind of art project that we saw where you're inside of, you're using a 360 camera, you're inside this box, and when you look up, you see humans, and they're, like, they're looking down at you, and then they close the box, and you're inside this little box with a bunny rabbit, a little bunny rabbit, and you're, like, right eye to eye with it, and they open the box, and you and the rabbit kind of look up at these people, and they're talking about you, and then they shut the top, and when they shut the top, like, I was so, like, alone and scared, and it was amazing, and I couldn't, like, I was like really feeling it. Like, man, this is how animals feel when we shut them in cages, right? And that's an experience I could not have gotten in Second Life, in Facebook, I had to have that piece of technology to tell that story and feel. And you know, I'm coming home more of a touchy-feely guy, you guys. That's what I'm trying to say.
You could really get that same vibe from, like, a refrigerator box, dude. Just kidding. That's great. It sounds very Twilight Zone-y there, Greg. So
yeah, that's good.
I'm glad. Well, listen, thanks very much for sharing. South by is again, always a great event. And I'm so glad that you are so involved in it and are so great at articulating it. Thanks very much for sharing the time with us, brother.
Thanks, guys.
Take care,
Talk
Greg.
To you soon.
All right, bye.
Bye.
So it's always great to hear from Greg.
No kidding.
And
that was
once
awesome.
Once again, just lots of stuff going on. And Greg's doing some really good stuff over at Space 150. So kind of keep your eye on what's going on over there as well. So, hey, quickly, let's do our cool thing of the week, Steve. Okay.
Well, I alluded to mine already. I was at the auto show, sat in the 2017 Chevy Volt.
This is your car?
Dug apart. And,
this is your car.
Well, let me finish. And I haven't driven the new one, so I have to wait on the driving the new one. But I got to tell you that based on, you know, really picking the thing apart at the auto show, and I talked to a couple of other people there, and then I read some articles after the auto show. It is just really hit the sweet spot, because I need something where I have zero range anxiety, because when I go on my photography adventures and I take off and I, you know, like this year, I'm going to drive up to Glacier National Park in Montana, and there's not going to be charging stations up there, so I can't have an electric car on the way, you know, heading through North Dakota, for example. So that's my cool thing.
So this gets 53 miles of battery range, right?
Yes.
Is that what it says? But it's up to 420 miles with total range on full charge and a full tank of gas.
Yeah. So we, not a full tank, but well, I mean, it is a container.
It says full tank of gas. You're right here. 420 miles, total range at a full charge and full tank of gas.
Yep.
That doesn't seem like much. How big is the tank?
Well, but wait, because all it does is it charges the battery, right? It doesn't actually drive the car. But my Prius has 485 mile range. If you look at the 20 some gallon tanks in like a Chevy Tahoe, the range is like 475 miles. So it's very, very average.
Dude, I get 700 on my Honda Accord.
Well, hybrid. It's a hybrid. But again, you know, the thing about a hybrid is that the range is variable. So, you know, there are times when, like once, when Alex and I drove down to Chicago in my 2009 Prius, we ended up with 560-some mile range because I was doing a little hypermiling, but I was averaging about 52 mpg because there was no air conditioning or heat on and perfect weather and the road was clean and all that. And so you can really extend your range as well. So that's why it's kind of variable, but anyway, so that's it. So what's your cool thing, my friend?
My cool thing is if you need to chill out, here's a really nice little website for you to check out. It's called Soft Murmur. I believe it's a Soft Murmur. There's a link in the show notes to it. But if you just need ambient noise while you're working at your computer,
this
is the place to go.
Can you hear? You can hear this, right? That
no,
I'm playing it. Okay.
No, I can't hear.
Well, here's a coffee shop. No, it's not a coffee shop. What? Oh, that's because I've got the waves on at the same time. That's
yes,
kind of cool. Okay.
Yeah. Right. You can actually combine. You get rain, thunder, waves, wind, that sort of a thing.
Yeah.
Birds, that sort of, it's just ambient noise. And you can actually mix them together if you'd like. So you could have crickets in a coffee shop.
Got
if you
it.
Really dig that.
So, sweet.
Check it out. It's called a Soft Murmur.
Sounds
it's
good.
Nice little break today. And it has an Android app. Nothing on iOS yet, but it does have an Android app.
Oh, there isn't anything on iOS. Okay.
Nope.
Well, all right.
There you go.
I guess that's, that's what am I going to do?
So who knew that with only two people on the podcast, we'd actually go longer than we usually go with three?
I know,
so,
it's scary, but it was
there
great.
There you go.
Well, hey, I want to just mention one thing about IoT Fuse.
Yes, sir.
Right now, 85% of the tickets are gone.
Right.
So if you want a link, go to IoTFuse.com. There's a button right on the front, just click that and it'll take you to Eventbrite and you can sign up for a ticket. They're free, but we really want you to come, so please do.
I'll be there.
Make sure you get registered right away because we are running out.
Sounds great.
All right.
Well, that's it for this week. We'll see what happens next week in the world of Minnesota innovation, and we'll talk about it on
the Minivate Gang Podcast. Take care.
Cheers.
whisky che sapeva di terra e di suola. La vecchia Peggy sorrideva e ci chiamava da sotto alle lenzuola. In programma niente, né duelli, né coltelli, né corse. Tutti col bicchiere pieno pieno attorno al pianoforte. E la figlia di O'Connor ballava bianca, bella, terribile. Per noi figli del pozzo era una visione irraggiungibile. E quel pianista dannazione, le sue dita profumavano di polvere nera. Forse proprio sopra alle sue note combiniamo alla festa stasera. L'inventore del jazz passava di qui e chi lo vide suonare lasciò tutto e partì. Quella nuova faccia era da raccontare, musica da sentire, da bere, da urlare. Padri mormoni sapevano leggere ma non odiare. E se lo schiavo nero era fuggito non restava che sedersi e ascoltare. Quelle mani dure da contadino senza troppa esperienza ma tanto orecchio. E le nostre scarpe sembravano ballare da sole davanti allo specchio. Passava di qui e chi lo vide passare lasciò tutto e partì. Quella nuova storia era da raccontare, che la musica era libera e il padrone